This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Optics teachers of the world unite. You have nothing to lose. Your pupils' illogical chains of reasoning and superficial knowledge that will keep them out of level four. Join me and my special guest today as we discuss everything from comparative theory and ideology to evaluation. Plus anything else that you would like to discuss.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
A very good afternoon, and welcome to the latest edition of the Sunday Lunchtime Show with me, Chris Wilkinson, on Teachers Talk Radio. As always, I will be here on alternate Sundays to share with you topics that I believe are very close to the heart of teachers. And this week, I thought, in the run-up to the term three, which for me begins tomorrow, it may well begin at a different time for other people, but it starts for me tomorrow, and I was just thinking this could be the perfect time to have an in-depth discussion around politics and the teachers who will be spending the next several weeks learning how to, or asking our students to learn material that maybe they haven't done for a while, and is there a way to work on the structure more as well, so that we're not just constantly teaching content but also helping students out in other ways as well. So the aim of today's session is to take a look at what we mean by comparative theory, and, you know, as teachers, we know what it means. We've probably been teaching it for a while. What is expected from ideologies papers? But also other aspects as well, such as evaluation and just, you know, how to deal with a rather heavy spec, which, let's be honest, anyone teaching A-levels will know that it's a heavy spec, and it's not a criticism of politics as such, because my colleagues who teach all the other subjects like sociology and history and psychology, they also struggle or have that challenge of trying to fit everything in. And some of us may well go to the wire with it. You know, I know in the past, especially in the COVID years, we were delivering right up until the last week of term, well, the last week before the exam. So how can we make that easier as well? And I have a guest today, David, who will be giving us some insight into how he helps his learners with comparative theory, and how comparative theory can be dealt with a bit more efficiently than perhaps what some of the specifications talk about as well. So before we do, I always make a quick start to talk about anything that is topical at the moment. And I would just like to start as a well wishes for anybody who's recently gone through Ramadan and is now celebrating Eid. So it's a very happy Eid Mubarak to you all. And also, again, for Easter, just making sure, hoping that everybody's had a lovely Easter as well. So I also would like to take time to discuss with us today as well just how the evaluation works with this as well. And, you know, we will all be sitting here knowing how to do an evaluation question. This is not what it's about. It's about how can we, you know, how can we perhaps make teaching more adaptive for everyone so that everyone can rise to the levels in this. And with ideology as well, when we get onto ideology later, I think that the main thing is to break the level two barrier. If you can get past level two for ideology, then there's no reason why we can't move that forward and go up the levels from there. So we'll have a big insight into that also today. So we will be discussing this in more content today. And so the running order today will be comparative theory, and then ideology, and then evaluation. And if we can do all that today, then I think that we'll be absolutely in a really strong position to help our learners moving forward today. So without further ado, we are going to start talking about comparative theory today.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
So I'd like to start today looking at comparative theory. And now I must confess that I am a EdXL teacher. So I do the EdXL specification, but I do write for the Politics Review magazine. And so when we do comparative theory, we have to also consider AQA and how they run the specification as well. So this isn't going to be EdXL heavy. The attempt is to make this as generic as possible, just by looking at the three comparative theories as we look at this. Now, as a EdXL teacher, I can say that the specification has it so that it's almost considered to be a sixth element, really, alongside the Constitution and democracy and so on. We can see that as we go through, but what I'm hoping what we can look at today is looking at how we can integrate a comparative theory into our content rather than teaching it standalone. And after speaking with a couple of teachers already, it's quite clear that a lot of us are already doing this. So I'm just quite keen to see how other people are doing this as well, and whether or not it's something that is similar to how I do this as well. So how I do this, just to give you a bit of an insight, for every topic we do, whether it's the US Constitution, whether it's Congress, electoral systems or whatever, what I'll do is I will complete a chart. I will have a chart out for all the learners so that every single topic is covered within that chapter, if you like. So for the US Constitution, there'll be a section on amendments, there'll be a section on the Bill of Rights, there'll be a section on all the other aspects as well, such as enumerated powers, implied powers, and so on. And as I do this, there's a section for each one, and I quite simply ask students to consider the similarities and differences as we go through. But not only do I use the comparative theories for that, I'll also drop in a green and a red box as well for them to maybe consider anything that they would think of from an evaluation point of view. So that could be something like, that it's democratic or that it's powerful. So if it's Congress, it could be that the green aspect of Congress is that they are powerful, that their checks and balances are more powerful than the Supreme Court or the presidency. But also there's the other section as well, where we look at the comparative theory, and this is the part to look at now. So I always find that with comparative theory, as we know, there's three comparative theories altogether. We've got to look at the rational theory, we've got to look at structural theory, and we've got to look at cultural theory. Now, in terms of the rational theory, we know that this is to do with individuals. Okay, so if we can look at the difference between individuals, then that's a really good thing to do. So for my article I've recently published, I talked about the difference between the US cabinet and the UK cabinet. Now, it would appear that this would be, as you can imagine, a group thing. So you would think it's technically more cultural, but actually it's a lot to do with the individual as well, because it's the power that's being commanded by the respective heads, such as the president and the prime minister. But also the individual could also be the individual member of the cabinet or the individual member of the US cabinet. In that sense, so it can work both ways, can't it? So there's a good way to do that. Now, when we look at individuals for comparative theory, I think it's very important to understand that when we are looking at this, that we are only looking at an individual at that moment in time. Okay, so if that individual becomes a group of individuals, then we're tipping into the cultural theory, aren't we? And it's just about being able to know the difference between them, really. So the first thing to say to a student in this situation is, if you're in doubt as to whether or not it's an individual or a group thing, so whether it's a rational or cultural thing, just think about your pronouns. Are you saying he, she, they, or are you saying that it's them, you know, in terms of more than one? And if we can see that there's more than one, then clearly that becomes more of a cultural thing. But I also think as well with rational theory that it is always structural, or a lot of it can be structural. So I think when I've been doing a lot of this, I found that it's easier for quite a number of times to be able to drop in some structural things, because, you know, the US Constitution is guided. The US politics is guided by the US Constitution. So if it's to do with pressure groups, or it's to do with, well, we'll say interest groups is a good point to begin with. For interest groups, you know, this could very much be a structural thing, because, you know, interest groups, for example, are able to spend, you know, the soft money the way they do because of the, you know, the Supreme Court's ruling, which of course is an implied power, but you know, it's through a judicial review, but it can be a structural matter in that, you know, the US Constitution allows for that. So there's always a way to factor in the structural details, and I think it's a very good thing to be able to do that, really. Now, in terms of the cultural structure and rational points on this, it's also important to understand how to do this in terms of how it's written in your answers as well. Now, as an examiner, I spend the month of June and half the month of July, at least, looking at a lot of comparative theory questions. And we spend a weekend as part of our pre-standardization going through these rational, structural, and cultural answers. And what is quite clear to see from this is that teachers are able to tell their students what a rational, cultural, and structural thing is. It's very rare that the points I've made before are difficult for learners to understand. And I think that the reason for that is because that's drilled into them, that they know that one's rational, one's cultural, one's structural. However, despite that, we don't see a lot of 12-mark answers, as in answers that reach the 12 marks. And we actually very rarely see level 4 answers, because I think there's common mistakes made with comparative theories that I just think we need to be able to consider here. So I think the first issue that we have with comparative theory is that there's a lot of apples and pears answers. I think that's the best way to describe it. I've heard it being known as cats and dogs, black and white answers, whichever, you know, whatever analogy you want to use to describe what we mean by these, but what we mean by these particular answers. So an apples and pears answer, we'll go with apples and pears because it's the one that I use. But for apples and pears, what you might have is, let's go with similarity as well. We might have it where a candidate will write, or one of your students will write something like, let's say, the US president is able to veto legislation. Okay, so that's a nice easy one to go with there. Okay, now, in order to see the similarity there, what we need to be able to see is that the similarity is with legislation first and foremost, but also the most direct comparison would probably be the Prime Minister. It doesn't have to be, of course. We don't have to think the President and the Prime Minister always the direct comparative point, but they often are, as you can probably imagine. So yeah, you've got this situation where you've got this student who's saying this one thing, but then they will go off as their comparative element and say, so similarity to this might be with the president, sorry, the prime minister. And rather than saying, you know, veto on legislation, I mean, is there a comparative element to that? Can we say that there's something similar to the president there? Because we know the president can't veto legislation. In fact, it would be odd for the prime minister to want to veto legislation, given that it's often their legislation that they're pushing anyway, isn't it? So, you know, so straight away we're at a bit of a wall there. But a student might think that a similarity might be the fact that they are able to pass secondary legislation, you know, because in their mind they are very similar in that they are controlling legislation. Now, in this situation, it's very loose, isn't it? It's a very loose similarity. In fact, it's so loose that it's not, in fact, a similarity, is it? But you can perhaps see why students might think that. So instead, unless the Prime Minister can veto legislation, we can't really see that there's a similarity in that instance. Of course, we can say that there's a difference there, which is quite easy to do because, you know, we would talk about that. Now, if we look about the difference, because it's easier to do this particular example as a difference instead. So they've correctly identified that the Prime Minister cannot veto legislation, whereas the President can veto legislation. So they've done well there. Okay, so that's a tick in the box in that they have correctly identified it. Now, like I'm saying to you, it's quite obvious as well as we go through this that that learners are actually also able to identify it's the correct one as well. So, you know, so for example, Prime Minister can veto legislation, whereas the Prime Minister can't. This is a structural thing, you know, in that Article 2 of the Constitution allows the President to do this, whereas the President can't do this. Sorry, the Prime Minister can't do this. Because of, you know, whatever convention or whatever, but what they struggle to do at this point is actually find the links that connects them. So this is how I do it as my structure. Okay, so I would start with the president does this. Okay, so the president can veto legislation as per Article 2. Of the US Constitution. The president is able to veto legislation through various different ways and give an example, okay? And you might give an example of a recent president who's done that, you know, Obama or whoever. And then what I find with my learners, I don't just necessarily mean candidates across the country, but just with my learners as a whole, they get a bit lazy at this point. And I don't know if they mean to be lazy. I mean, I can speak about my students. I don't know about yours, but they think, okay, I've made my point and I'm just going to finish it up because I must get another couple of points in. So I don't know if it's lazy or whether or not they're just rushing or what, but they will tend to then go, right, the president can't, however, the prime minister can't do that. And then they'll move on. And, you know, as much as that sounds like a bit of a rounded answer, it's not. It's not. It's half an answer. Because unless we can prove that, you know, the Prime Minister does something else, how do we know that what they're saying is correct? So to make that a more well-rounded answer, what we also need to do is we need to give an example from the Prime Minister's point of view as well. Now, we can't we can't give evidence of a negative, can we? So we can't say the Prime Minister can't do that. An example is when, you know, because you can't provide an example of when they haven't vetoed legislation, but they would have to change the language a little bit, wouldn't they? So instead, what we would say is something along the lines of the Prime Minister instead is only able to produce secondary legislation. Secondary legislation is, an example is this. Now, even when they do that, it's still not quite there, is it? Because all they've done is provided a point for one thing, a point for another, and give an example for each one. You're nearly there, but you're not quite there. So what else do they need to do here? Well, my advice would always be just to give that final sentence, just to sweep it up there. So it would be something like the Prime Minister can do this. The President can do this. However, the Prime Minister can't do this. Instead, they can do this. Therefore, the difference between them is... Now, what is the difference here between them? Is it the fact that the President is the head of state as well as the head of the executive? Therefore, that's the key difference, isn't it? It's not just that the President can do this, the Prime Minister can't do this. Why? Why is it that they can't do it? What is the difference between them? And just, it's a sentence that would finish it off. And of course, you would throw in some rational theory in there as well. So you could say something like, rational theory suggests that the Prime Minister has the authority to veto legislation. Or you could say structural theory as well, of course. This is in the Article 2 of the Constitution. For example, President so-and-so did this on this particular date. However, the Prime Minister is unable to veto legislation because it's not in the UK Constitution. Instead, they can pass secondary legislation as well as their cabinet, and other members of the government can pass secondary legislation instead, which is also controlled by Parliament. Therefore, the difference between these is that the President is head of state, the Prime Minister is not, and that's why it's a rational, in my view, in that point, a rational theory choice there. So it's about collecting the two and bringing them together as well. Now, in terms of that, it's, like I said, it's very difficult it almost works best for me, at least anyway, as a plenary. So if we've done a particular topic, such as the President, Congress or whatever, we would use that as a plenary. Now, I find as well that you can't really get going with comparative theory until you're so far into it as well. Into the US specification as well. I find that, especially if you start with the US Constitution, you can do comparative theory with that. Comparative theory tends to get easier when you're looking at Congress, the Supreme Court, and the presidency as a whole. So my Twitter handle, just to share with you, because what I'll do is I will post some of my resources on there so you can see what chart I use. I'll also add it to the Politics Teachers Facebook page as well, for anybody who would like that as well. So my Twitter handle is Chris. In fact, I don't know if I can just put it in the... for those listening live, I will pop it into the chat. But for those listening on feedback, it's Chris_W1987. And what I shall do is I shall add my resources to Twitter and to the Facebook page as well. I am also on LinkedIn as well, just so that you can see what the charts are and how they work. And it really does work best if you do it in class as well. I mean, you can offer it as homework. We also know that the specification is very heavy, and we really can't do much about that, can we? Except to try and maybe give some for homework. But it does work best when they work together because the specification is so wide, and American politics is so wide as well. I would imagine the same for global politics as well. that there's a whole raft of different answers that the students can give. And it might be that the learners or the students give one, give one answer, and somebody else gives another, and they go, oh, that's much better than what I have. And of course, that's when your adaptive teaching comes in, and all the different types of pedagogy that comes with doing that as well. It's a really good way to do it. And I would recommend strongly as well that you could even have it so that you're not doing it one at a time. It could be that one table is working on one area of it and another, then you swap over. There's various different ways to reduce or make the comparative part of it very, very efficient. But it's a bit like ideology, which we'll move on to after in a little while. It covers, 24 marks out of 84 on the Excel paper, and I think it's 2 9-mark questions, I think, for AQA. And that is a great changer, isn't it? It really is. To get them to right is an absolute great changer. And it's really difficult though with the 15 minutes or so that you have to complete this. If you work out the timings, it's about 15 minutes for the Excel paper, and it's very difficult to squeeze all that in. And so we get on to the age-old question, do you need 3 points in order to get the full marks? And, we've looked at 2 points that have achieved level 4 because of the depth that they've got into. So it's a myth for it to think that you need to have 3 points in order to get to achieve, a level 4. I would say it's obviously a lot easier to get level 4 with 3 excellent points. But that all comes down to the ability of the learner to write quick and to be able to have that information, on their working memory as they go, something that they would obviously need to train for as part of their revision. Because let's not forget that timing is a big part of our revision as well. And I don't know if anybody else experiences problems with timing as well, and whether or not you ask your students to do the comparative theory first or to do it last. I mean, I say you ask them. I mean, ultimately, it's their choice in the exam, but you could certainly advise them to do that first or second. I advise them to go first, to do it first, because I think if your timing is wrong, your timing's wrong anyway. So if, for example, you need 50 for Edexcel politics, I do apologize for anybody who's listening who might do, say, AQA global, because you might not feel very well represented here. But I think this is a universal point across all politics papers, that if your timing is wrong, then your timing is wrong. Whether or not you do the 15, the small questions first or second, you're always going to make time for your big questions, your essay questions. So you're always going to do that, aren't you? But if you get your timing right, there's no reason why you shouldn't do the 12 mark questions first or the 9 mark questions first, because regardless, after 15 minutes, you move on to the next one. So if your exam starts at 9:30, you should be finished by 10, the comparative questions anyway. Now, if your students have practiced the timing, they may well get 3 points in. But if they have practiced the timing, they can only get 2 points in. But them 2 points are excellent. I personally can't see how you should try and get them to make that third point if it might potentially compromise the other 2 points. Because we know our students well. We know that they can practice and practice and practice, but panic stations kick in, and all of a sudden the form goes out the window. And so a nice calm point with everything we've said there, double that up, you're looking at a very, very good mark there, as long as it's accurate. And there's no reason why it can't achieve level 4 if it is, in fact, excellent. So just as a recap there for comparative theory, we want to be taking a look at making a point, And providing that with an example, having an example as evidence to back that up as well. Now, that point must be met with either a distinct comparative point or a contrast, you know, so if we're going to compare that one, then we need to be able to make sure that the second point is married with exactly the same things, a point and an example. But by providing the points and examples, not enough without providing that extra final point just to really hit home and make it clear what the key similarity or difference is. So the similarity might be that they're both head of executive, or if it's the Supreme Court, that they're both independent, or that they're both impartial. Whereas if it's a comparative point where we're looking at differences, the difference might be that the the Prime Minister is not head of state but just head of executive, or that the Supreme Court are not selected independently in the US but they are selected independently in the UK. Appointed in that sense. So we are going to move on a little while to comparative theory, but if there's anybody who's got any points that would like to make about comparative theory before we move on, please use this time to do so.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher, or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more, and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
The BBC reported on a long-term study by the Institute of Fiscal Studies, which found children living near Sure Start centres did better at GCSE. The research says these living near a centre performed up to 3 grades better than those living further away. Sure Start began in 1998 to support new parents, especially in disadvantaged areas, but due to austerity, many have since closed. The Department for Education said its Family Hub scheme had a number of advantages over the Sure Start model. The IFS study used postcodes from when children were age 5 to determine proximity to centres, and looked at the GCSE results of those children 11 years later. It found what it describes as big improvements in performance in those living near a centre, especially those from low-income backgrounds. Former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, Labour Chancellor at the time the initiative was launched, said the UK now needs a new Sure Start, and described the results as what most parents already know, that a supportive environment in early years was life-transforming. Among all children in the study, those who live near a Sure Start centre performed better than those who lived far away, but the trend was most pronounced amongst those eligible for free school meals and those from minority ethnic backgrounds. According to The Guardian, schools in England could lose up to £1 billion in funding by 2030, with exceptional falls in pupil numbers prompting closures. Mergers and school closures are already happening in parts of London, where pupil numbers have been falling for some time. According to the think tank Education Policy Institute, the North East is projected to see the greatest decline in primary pupil numbers, down by 13% by 2028-29. At secondary school level, Yorkshire and Humber, the North East and London are projected to have the largest falls in pupil numbers, although other areas, including the West Midlands and the South East, have rising numbers. Pupil numbers had grown because of a fertility surge in the 2000s, but as that cohort has moved through, numbers are now falling. Even with increases in per pupil funding, the EPI predicts schools will find it hard to balance budgets as fewer pupils do not lead to reduced costs. The decline is due mainly to a falling birth rate and changing migration patterns. Full details of the EPI projections can be found on the Guardian website. Schools Week reports on the decision by Ofsted to appoint a former chief inspector, Dame Christine Gilbert, to lead the independent inquiry into its response to the death of Ruth Perry. Dame Christine served as the HMCI from 2006 to 2011 and now chairs the Education Endowment Foundation. The learning review follows a coroner's ruling in December that an Ofsted inspection contributed to the death of Mrs. Perry, then head teacher of Caversham Primary School. The review will consider actions Ofsted took in response to hearing about the death of Ruth Perry. Dame Christine will have access to relevant records, Ofsted staff, and the opportunity to meet with Ruth Perry's family as part of the review. The review will not examine the November 2022 inspection of Caversham Primary. Teaching unions have expressed concern about the appointment of Gilbert, saying it was critical that the review was robust, independent, and impartial, and that some would, rightly, question the notion of a former HMCI reviewing the work of Ofsted. A report will be completed after the review and recommendations will focus on future actions. Schools Week also reports on a plan for the Department for Education to work with the Scout Association to provide 40,000 explorers, those aged 14 to 18, with the skills and knowledge they need to consider a career in teaching. The DfE will work with the Scouts to create age-appropriate activities that inspire young people to consider a career in teaching, linking to relevant badges and awards. It did, however, clarify that there are currently no plans for a teaching badge. The policy is part of the DfE's Get Into Teaching plan, which aims to elevate the status of the profession and target new audiences who have not yet considered teaching as a career. The scheme will launch in September, and it is hoped that it will reach 40,000 young people. The Scouts will create support and guidance material for those running the programme. The initial one-year contract is worth £43,000, but can be extended subject to budget availability. Finally, a teenager who campaigned for skateboarding to be included in school qualifications is proud to see it added to the list of approved GCSE sports in Wales. According to the report on the BBC News website, Qualifications Wales has added 13 new sports to the approved list for GCSE PE. Other newly allowed sports include BMX, shooting, kickboxing and wakeboarding. The new Made for Wales GCSE in Physical Education and Health will be available for first teaching from September 2026. The change makes Wales the second UK nation to include skateboarding, behind Northern Ireland. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Jo Fox.
Welcome back to Teachers Talk Radio with your host, Chris Wilkinson, and we're here talking about A-level politics in the run-up to the exams in the forthcoming term. So I've just been discussing a moment ago, comparative theory and how we can work on improving comparative theory in our time, the time that we've got left, and trying to make things more efficient as well. And I'm hoping for anybody who didn't quite hear that, who's just joining us, you can go back and catch up after the show to listen to it again at any point. Now, I also want to go on and discuss with you some points around ideology. And I must say, ideology is a strange one for me because I'm sure other people are in the same position as well. It wasn't before the 2017 reforms, it wasn't a topic or it wasn't an area that I was particularly familiar with. It wasn't an area that I taught at all. And I am a self-proclaimed non-politics specialist in that my background wasn't originally in A-level politics. I've taught it now for 12 years and I've been examining that time as well, as well as doing other projects along the way, such as writing for Politics Review and TU and other areas. So I'm very much familiar with all aspects of the spec and know it inside out enough to do this, of course. But it wasn't something that I would say that I was particularly competent with. And when the spec changed, I was a little bit nervous about doing ideologies, I'll be honest. And I actually think, despite that, I actually got a good deal, or we got a good deal for those who were American students, because I think it could have easily gone the other way, where, you know, ideologies could have been a bigger thing than it is, and politics, US politics, could have been reduced, or global politics could have been reduced instead. So I'm fortunate of the way it went, but if you only taught ideologies and you had to learn either global or American, my heart goes out to you, honestly, because it was hard enough doing ideologies without having to learn something that was huge as well. And for me, ideologies takes up a term, about half term, should I say. I work in a college, so I don't get the 6 weeks that other schools get to start ideology after the exams. I'm there. Here I am doing an ideology September to, you know, the half term. And honestly, it's all I can do. It's the only time that we've got, and I would love to spend more time on it. But I find that by the time we get to, because I do it as most people do, you start off with liberalism, conservatism, then socialism, and then feminism. I do feminism, of course. The other ideology, other non-core ideologies are available too. And I think by the time we get to feminism or even socialism, I think learners do now get the point as to how the structures go, and the only thing that changes is content, the key thinkers, key terms, that sort of thing. But they do start off really, really struggling with it, and I find that you need to spend longer with liberalism than perhaps maybe you do with socialism because of that. Not too much longer, but you know, you might use the period before September. You know, after the exams, you give them some reading material. You might give them liberalism to do so that they have longer on it so they can get used to it as well. But I was, you know, despite being now quite competent with ideologies, and again, being an examiner for paper one really helps with that, because you do get to look at a lot of different ranged answers and you understand why the ranges are the way they are. Despite that, I was very surprised in the most recent exam series as to how very little students actually achieved less than half marks in ideology. And, you know, perhaps maybe in your teaching, when you got your results back, if you went on to the AQA website or the, Results Plus on NXL, and you broke down what answers they got, maybe you did struggle with the maybe you saw that they did struggle with the ideology's questions, and you know, it's that Sod's Law thing, isn't it, where you know you're sitting there, or I'm sitting there marking some papers thinking, oh, I wish I'd done that myself, and you're sitting in standardization or pre-standardization and you're sitting there going, oh no, I wish I'd done that as well. you know, it's quite a common thing to do, isn't it, to wish you'd done that. So, you know, we put it right this year instead, and we put all the good practices in place. And yeah, just figuring out why it is that ideologies didn't do so well. Now, I'll explain why. I'll give an explanation why, and then we'll see if anybody has if anybody agrees with that. Because I do think it's quite a common thing that people didn't quite understand, or you know. So the main thing with ideologies, it's knowing your strands. I think that's the main thing to get right from the beginning. It's knowing your strands. Now, it's okay knowing what the key thinkers are and who the key thinkers are. In fact, for a level 4 answer, of course, a level 5 answer, you will need to know that, won't you? You will need to know who the key thinkers are, who said what, who belongs to which strand, and whatever, of course. But I think knowing your strands, first and foremost, is easily the most important thing that we need to do. Now, I have a colleague who I reached out to ask about ideologies. Well, I asked a group of people about ideologies, and one of my colleagues got back to me, and I'm just going to read out what he said, because I think it was there's an excellent piece that he said. So if you are listening, Tim, thank you very much for this. I basically reached out to my colleagues and said, look, I'm doing a show on A-level politics, one of which will be about ideology. So is there any way to, is there any points that you can make? And so he said, how about decoding ideology's questions? So for example, identifying the core principles, which is it's a really good point, isn't it? So, when we're looking at liberalism, you know, who is or what is core liberalism and what is classical liberalism, you know, and what is modern liberalism? So what's the difference between classical liberalism and modern liberalism? And really knowing that really before identifying key thinkers and things like that as well. So, we have the four elements, don't we? We have the economy, we have, human nature and state and society. So when you look at them things, what is the core point about ideology when we do that as well? So how do we look at that? So for example, let's tap into liberalism with the economy for a moment. Okay, now I'm not gonna go deep into content here. I'm just using this as an example, as you can understand. Okay, so there's a chart for this, by the way. I've got a chart for ideologies as well, and I will share this as well on my Twitter page and on other things as well, on Facebook and on LinkedIn as well. We have a chart, okay? So it's looking at it and saying, okay, so you've got the economy, but not just the economy, but the core principles around that as well. So if we pick out, I don't know, what's a good point, what's a good one for liberalism, let's say the equality. Okay, so equality is one of the core principles of liberalism. So the six of them all together, one of them is equality, and we know that you can't be a liberal unless you believe in this core principle. Now, the core principles are obviously skewed according to whether or not you're a classical or a modern liberal, but there is still that element of equality that's there, isn't there? So if we take a look at them both and see how this goes, okay? So if we were to, if a question went something like, to what extent do liberals agree on equality? And I don't think you would get anything as nice as that, but, you know, let's just say that is the case. We can look at it from an economy point of view. We can look at it from a human nature, from a society or a state point of view. So let's take a look at, let's go with the state. State's a good one to do here, okay? So before we get on to key thinkers and whatever, we're splitting the two up here, and we're saying, right, what is, what is to what extent do they agree with this? Now, I We got a good question on liberalism in the summer, and it was about how much do they fear the state. And I think what we need to understand here when it comes to an ideology question is, the question isn't just saying, you know, to what extent do they agree, although it might actually say that. It's actually saying, how big is the agreement compared to the disagreement? Or how big is the disagreement compared to the agreement? Now, I have got an ideologyometer. I always say it really quick because otherwise I can't say it. And it's a bit like a gauge, you know, think of it like a gauge. So if it's flat, there's nothing on it, the gauge is dead. But the gauge might go right the way around, all the way to 100%. And that would be, you know, 100% agreement. Now, we know that with ideology, the question is never going to be the case where they're going to have 100% agreement or 100% disagreement. So, for example, if we ask a question about to what extent do liberals agree on equality, there's always going to be some room for agreement and some room for disagreement. But the question is, how much do they agree and how much do they disagree on this point? So I always get my students to get the gauge and just, you know, and put it where they think it is. Is it halfway? So they're partly there, partly not. Is it three quarters of the way? Is it 80%? But that 20% is because of something else. I don't know. So if we were to look at the state with equality, where would we put that gauge? It can't be 100% agreement, because we know that the size of the state is a question that both the classical and modern liberals would contest. But we know that's not 100% disagreement, because we do know that the state has some obligation towards the equality. But it's the level of engagement that we, you know, that we're questioning here, isn't it? So how does that reflect in an answer? Do we just simply provide ways in which they provide agreement and way in which they provide disagreement, and then that's it? Or is that not what an ideology question is asking for? Well, I can tell you categorically that is not what the ideology question is asking you to do. It's never going to say, you know, it's not a GCC question where you just have to dip in, give both examples and leave. You have to leave that answer with your point as to where they are in terms of their agreement. So if we did the state, we could say one way in which liberals agree with the role of the equality is to do with the state. So classical liberals believe that the state should be negative freedom, and, you know, and so on. So I'm not going to do a full answer, as you can understand, but you got that point. And then you could say that modern liberals agree to an extent with this, but their disagreement lies with the size of the state and that the economy, you know, and so on and so forth. And you could bring in how there's a difference there. But without going into the, I haven't got my notes in front of me, so I'm not going to embarrass myself by going through a full answer here. But as long as at some point in that point, the language refers to the fact that they agree on this, but their disagreement lies on this, and for this reason, the agreement is bigger than the disagreement, or the disagreement is bigger than the agreement. So if I was doing something on the stage without, you know, dictating a full answer to you off the top of my head, which I'm not going to do because I'll embarrass myself, especially after weeks of not actually looking at ideology, you know, you would just make the point that almost the final sentence will be something like, therefore, the agreement is bigger than the disagreement on the size of the state, because classical liberals cannot agree with modern liberals on how much state intervention is needed for this. So they would not believe in positive freedom or whatever. Okay, but as long as that language is made clear that the agreement is bigger than the disagreement, or so on and so forth. Now, that almost needs to be reflected right the way through, doesn't it? And you've only got half an hour to do this, haven't you? You've got half an hour to get as many points down as you can. Now, this is the age-old question with the ideology. Again, how many points makes it for a top answer here? Do you need to make 3 points? Or is two enough again? Or do we need to do more? You know, how many points do we need to make? Well, my advice I would give to students in this situation is not to worry about the amount of points you make. It's about the points that you do make. They need to be in depth. They need to answer the question. And, you know, the timing, once you get the paragraphs perfect, then you can worry about timing. There's no point sitting half an hour away and seeing how much you can write if what you're writing is not going to get more than 9 marks out of 24, because the red line for ideologies with Edexcel is not providing that analysis. And you cannot provide analysis unless you categorically tell the examiner, or you, if you're marking it, if the agreement is bigger than the disagreement. If you don't do that, you're not going to get the marks. And, you know, you can write 100 pages in half an hour. If you don't do that, it doesn't matter. So I would honestly advise students at this stage in the year to get the paragraph right first and then worry about timing. Because that timing only matters if you get the points right first. So you make a point about how they agree, you make a point how they disagree. Of course, the agreements and the disagreements should link as well, of course. And then after that, you decide as a gauge, if you like, where they stand on that particular point. Do they agree or disagree? I don't know if liberalism is the right one to choose here. A really good one to use instead is conservatism. If you look at, say, the role of the state with conservatism, that's an absolute brilliant question to get, isn't it, really? And if, you know, if we were to look at that one very quickly as well, just as a bullet point headline as we go through, you would just say something like this, wouldn't you? So to what extent do conservatives agree on the state? You'd be putting this into a paragraph, wouldn't you? You'd be saying that traditional conservatives and new right conservatives tend to have a larger agreement with each other on the size of the state, because they believe in libertarianism. They believe that the state should be limited in terms of the economy as well. But obviously, even within them, new right conservatives have a much stronger view on this. So even their agreement isn't quite 100%. You would expect new right conservatives to want a more aggressive form of limited government. But then the disagreements lie with the One Nation conservatives, who believe in noblesse oblige. And, you know, by looking at that, you know, they're all not 100%. In fact, the disagreements generally tend to be stronger than the agreements, because every single one of them has a different idea as to what size the state is. And, you know, if you can throw a couple of key thinkers in and make that point there, then really that's what we're looking for. And I must say, our learners did their mock exams in December, and we were only just really getting going with America from about November time, so it wasn't enough to give them a mock exam on America in December. So, you know, I made it a mock exam on ideologies, and we only ever have to do one ideology, of course, for Edexcel, different for AQA, I don't know. But I only give them one. I give them one answer, and so I said, look at this. This one question that you're going to do, you know, out of 24, this is going to be your mock result. I actually give them longer than half an hour. I think I give them 45 minutes to do it, because again, I wasn't bothered about the timing. That comes much later. Timing kicks in a couple of weeks' time for us, but I just wanted them to have the freedom and the time to write a really strong answer. And, you know, I said to them before the mock exam, don't be surprised if you don't get more than 50%. In fact, if you get more than 50%, then that's a really good thing, because then you are breaking, you're breaking that ceiling that students really do struggle to break. And in some ways, I then said, actually, if you're getting 50%, there's no reason why you can't get more. But you know, I was really prepping them for the fact that it's not easy to get even, you know, 9 marks, 10 marks, 12 marks out of 24 if you don't do that thing right. And it actually worked out well in the end. I think I prepped them well enough for them to do well enough on it. I think the highest mark was still only about 60%, and the lowest mark was about 45%. So there was even after all that time, there was still a big struggle to get them that way. And when I give them the feedback after the mock exam, I pulled them all to side one by one and had a chat with them. And I think for every single one, I still had to say to them, why didn't you at the end of the sentence or at the end of the paragraph or even at the end of the whole thing, why didn't you say that the agreement was bigger or smaller than the disagreement? You know, after everything that we've said, why is it that, you know, you still didn't do that? And, you know, the thing is, I'm still having that conversation with them now with homework and whatever. And it's fine to have that conversation with them, because I can guarantee if you set your students the ideology question now, I can guarantee that they will, unless they've remembered it and done it, that's the one thing they'll miss out. They do the hard part. They can tell us the differences between one nation and, you know, third way, one nation and, you know, one new right conservatism. They can do that. But they can't tell me the extent of their disagreement. And I don't know. I don't think that's the most difficult thing on the answer, but it's the one thing that students always miss off. So if you want to really get your students ahead of the game, that's what they need to do. Very much so. And actually, when I was marking them in the summer, I started off, marking them, and I don't mind saying it, that when I was doing my standardization, I was struggling a little bit with it. I was looking at an answer that might have been 2 pages long, that was chocker block, that was jam-packed with key thinkers, key terminology, jam-packed with, quotes even. All these different things. And yet, when we were doing the standardization, everyone was saying, yeah, it's only worth this or this mark or whatever. And, it's still capped at 9 marks. I'm thinking, what on earth is going on? How can someone write such a good answer and it only be at 9 marks? But it's actually really obvious when you look back and think about it that is the reason. Because they haven't actually answered the question. There's no analysis there. You can't tell me the extent, or you can't tell the examiner the extent of the agreement or disagreement without saying whether or not the agreement is bigger or smaller than the disagreement. So, you know, that's certainly worth considering as you go through. So I hope that's really helped with ideology. And I hope that when you take a look at, or when your students get the chance to do ideologies again, that they have the opportunity to take a look at that final point. And it's almost like asking this thing to them, what is the headline line that you want to put in there? But instead of being the headline, it needs to be the last line, doesn't it? So what are you trying to say? So if you're telling me one nation and third way, one nation, we'll say third way. Okay, we'll go with socialism, because I clearly want to talk about third way for some reason. Social democrats and third way socialists, you can probably tell me that one big difference is their acceptance of capitalism. But to what extent? How far away are we talking? Are we talking a huge amount? Or has social democrats accepted capitalism? Because we know Marxists haven't. So, to what extent are we talking? Is there a 20%, 30% agreement there or whatever? So final point there is a headline, can they provide us with a headline figure to go home with?
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncatbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
Well, welcome back and to the final instalment of the A-Level Politics Special today. My name's Chris, and I will be with you for a further 20 minutes to discuss evaluation. So, this is the area that we will all need to be very good at for our students, because it's the area that's going to get us the most marks, isn't it? And it's the one area of the specification that I believe is about as clear as can be as to what's expected by the students. And we will forever spend our time saying to students, like a bit like ideologies, when we talk about, you know, making sure that they talk about that analysis part. With ideologies, it's like saying, have you made it clear where's the agreement and disagreement lie? A bit like comparative theory as well. Okay, you've told me that the president can't do that, but the prime minister can. Why? What is the key difference there? What is that headline, that one line that can sum up why they're different? Or for ideologies, what is that one line that can sum up why there is such a big difference and why the agreement is bigger than disagreement? So with evaluation, it's the same thing again. Are you telling me that you agree or that you disagree with the question? Now, if this was an AS paper, it would be a quote for NXL, but for A-level, it's just asking you to evaluate the view that, and they give you a statement, they drop it in there, and you've got to tell us what you feel. Now, I've got a chart for this as well. It's a bit like there's an app for everything. For me, there's a chart for everything. And I just, for this one, where students don't do particularly well, again, is the analysis, I find, with evaluation. Now, from day one, literally day one, I tell students that for the 30 mark questions, they must get off the fence. They must have a viewpoint one way or another. So evaluate the view that the checks and balances of Congress is ineffective. Okay, now you need to tell me if they're effective or ineffective. That needs to be summed up almost immediately from the beginning of the essay. I think that they are effective. I think that they're ineffective. Now, the level 5 answers will obviously give the headlines again as to why that is, but they need to tell us, even as low down as level 3, even lower, you need to tell us where you stand on something. And I actually find, actually, that students do that in my classes anyway. And I find that we tend to get that a lot with the answers as well, that most students can reach sort of level 3 for evaluation, because they do tend to say, whether or not the Congress or the president is powerful enough or whatever. Okay, they can do that. They can make that point. I think where they fall short is the analysis isn't there a lot of the time. So let me explain to you what I mean by analysis in terms of the essay questions. And if you already know this and you listen sort of thinking, I know this, then indulge me, please, because it might be that just hearing it always helps in these situations, doesn't it? Just to reinforce what you know. So analysis really is being able to provide a point. So if we go with, let's just go with the age old, who's more powerful, Congress or the president? Okay. So if I was to make the point that the president is more powerful, of course, I need to start off with a point there, don't I, that makes the president more powerful. So straight away, I'm thinking foreign policy. This is off the top of my head, okay? So foreign policy, the president can be more powerful on foreign policy. So I might start off with the general, you know, the president is more powerful because of foreign policy. Okay. It might be that we define what foreign policy is and whatever else. Of course, you do all that. And students tend to do a good job of that. They know what foreign policy is. They can even give an example, can't they? They're quite good at doing that as well. So it might be that for foreign policy, what an executive agreement might be a way that they're more powerful because they've got implied powers. For example, Obama with, you know, whatever. Okay. I think what students do very well is they are able to provide the point and provide the example. I think what students tend not to do well with is understanding or realizing that simply providing an example is still just knowledge and understanding. It's not enough to drop an example in and expect to get analysis marks for that. I think this is where level two can stay at level two. It's where it remains superficial. It's where we don't get into level three or above because of this inability to take that example for a walk, as I call it. What I mean by taking an example for a walk is you get that information and you do something with it. And it's that so what, isn't it? So what that you said that? What difference does that make to anything? So if I was to, say the president is more powerful because domestic affairs, because they have the ability to produce an executive order, and I might just drop in that a good example of an executive order where the president shows their superiority was the travel ban of 2017. Okay, now me saying that the President Trump issued an executive order for a travel ban in 2017 is a fact. It's nothing more than that. That's not analysis. Can't be analysis because you haven't analyzed anything. You haven't said anything that gives us any information as to why. So what we need to do is we need to take that information and we need to basically throw it in the examiner's face and say, this is why I'm using this point. I'm using this example because this is why it's the most powerful. It's not enough that I say it's there, this is why. So if I was to put my language to this and if I was to model this as an answer, I would say something like this. An executive order, the president is more powerful than Congress because of their ability to use an executive order. An executive order is an instruction given by the president to instruct members of the executive or, you know, public bodies and so on. Okay, however you want to word that. An example for this is Donald Trump's executive order of 2017, which banned people for coming from particular countries of Muslim origin. Okay, the reason why this is powerful is because an executive order immediately comes into action. It immediately requires agencies to follow out of president's instructions, and it can be withdrawn, it can be revoked, it can be declared unconstitutional, but only after a long due process. And in the meantime, that remains in power, and the president gets instantly what they want. Congress can't do that. And, you know, immediately I'm taking that further by just really making it clear why that is, isn't it? Therefore, this demonstrates without doubt that the president has superiority of power over Congress. And, you know, it's very, you know, hyperbolic, isn't it, me saying this? But it's true. It's really almost getting up excited about it and getting up in a bit of a height about why you think this is. So the analysis is there for that reason. Therefore, this shows that. And taking that information and really nailing it to the wall as to why it's on that side of the fence. You're on this side of the fence. You've got this point. You're nailing it to that side of the fence. Because, you know, if you can't do that, then it might not be that might tell you that's not the right example. It might tell you that's not the right answer. You know, if you can't tell us why that example is relevant to the point you're making, then it's probably not a good one. And I often find students in this trap sometimes, actually. So, you know, my level three answers students will maybe make a point. And it might be that they actually don't know why that example's there. They might have just written it down somewhere, so it's in their working memory to just keep using that example. And that in itself is a training issue for them, isn't it? But they might just put the wrong example down. Or they might say an executive agreement is more powerful because they don't have to go through Congress and the president gets what they want throughout their time in foreign policy. They'll go, okay, give me an example of that. And they might say, well, Obama with Cuba or whatever. And you go, well, okay, well, what about it? Oh, I don't know. Okay, well, scrap it. You can't use it. You need to tell them, scrap it. Okay? You can't tell me why that's relevant. It's gone. You cannot use that example. And it's just getting them to do that. And, you know, I actually put a line through it sometimes. You know, you have to know your learners, and you have to know that they're not going to cry if you do that. But, you know, put a line through it and say, why are you telling me this? You're not elaborating on it. So, you know, you're getting absolutely no AO2 for that. It's not there. And one learner said to me, and this was a really, you know, this was a really a good point that they said, well, that's fine, Chris. You know, I can spend ages doing this paragraph if you want, but I'm not going to get much more written down. And I really had to look at that and think, well, why not? Well, because you're asking us to write twice as much in that paragraph as I would have before. Okay, so how many points are you going to make if you do this paragraph properly? And I think they said, oh, I'll only probably manage two. Okay. So you're going to manage 2 points with two counter arguments, presumably, but using the correct structure there. Yeah. Okay. You're going to get twice as many marks as if you don't, if you put 3 points in, but you put no analysis in. Analysis is worth 10 marks. Okay. You're not going to get hardly any if you don't do what I'm saying. So it's back to that point that we said about ideology. You can write, or comparative theory, you can write 3 points down. But if you're not making them points right, then what's the point? Honestly, what is the point? You're far better off having less range and more depth. You will get more marks that way. There's no doubt about that. So my advice to anybody listening to this who has students who aren't putting the analysis in, they've got to get that right first. Absolutely. Now, there's a final point to make for the counter arguments, because I must stress as well that when I say I make a point, I assume that the point comes with a counter argument. So actually, 1 point is really 2 points, if that makes sense. So if I was to make the point that the president is powerful because of executive orders, my counter argument would be that executive orders can sometimes be perceived as weak. I don't want this apples and pears situation where I might say, well, the president's really strong at executive orders. On the other hand, Congress can impeach a president. Oof, it's not the same point. It's not the same point. So please don't do that. So when I'm saying a point about executive orders, I expect the counter argument to be the same point, but just obviously a counter argument instead. And I think some of the best answers, some of the sort of level five answers I see, are the ones where the student's almost gaslighting the counter argument. They're paying credence to it, but they're absolutely giving it no time or day whatsoever, but yet still manage to give an example and say why it might be, but just really, really just rubbishing it. So, here's a good example for you. So if I've already made the point that executive orders are good, they're powerful because they immediately come into effect and it takes due process to get rid of them, so the president gets what they want in the meantime, these are all strong things. I'm not going to obviously rubbish that because I believe that. Now, if I had a counter argument, I might say, on the other hand, some people might think this. Some people might make the point that executive orders are not as effective because Congress can remove them with a vote, or the president or the Supreme Court can declare them to be unconstitutional. For example, the Court of Maryland found that Donald Trump's travel ban was unconstitutional, and you know, or you could talk about how the executive order of affirmative action has been systematically stripped away, to the point where it actually has been stripped away essentially by the Supreme Court now, showing that executive orders have a shelf life, they're not very good. But, you know, even if we were making that point, you would say some people think that. However, I've already made it quite clear. So an example of this would be, you know, affirmative action or the travel ban or something. However, I don't agree with this point, because the president is still getting what they want. The president is still managing to get instant, and by the time it gets removed, the effect that the president wanted might have already happened. And so, you know, even though you are given a counter argument, it's very unbalanced. You know, I think we have to, students have to move away from the fact that they have to, it has to be on argument this, argument for, argument against, argument, you know. Yes, it does, but that language has to be clear that at some point, you know, one of the argument for or against, one of them is wrong, or one of them you think is wrong. And what's beautiful about, you know, American politics is that you can go either way with this. I mean, I could easily just as easily provide an argument that executive orders are weak, and therefore the president overall is weaker. Like, you can easily do that. That's the beauty of this. And I think that's sometimes why students struggle. And I'll often say, right, if we're going to do a model answer together, I might say to them, okay, show of hands, who agrees, who disagrees, who's not sure? And that third one, there's a lot of people who don't put their hands up, and they'll go, well, I could go either way with this. And, you know, my advice to them and to any teacher who experiences this is, you just say to them, of course you can. But you have to make it clear that you only have one answer to this. And, you know, guess what? You can even lie. You can actually, you know, no one's going to come around and see you afterwards and say, right, how do you really feel about that? Just produce a compelling argument. After all, this is what politicians do. This is the skill that you have to put right, you know. How many politicians argue for something that they don't believe in because it's the party line, you know? So just it's a skill for politics to be able to do that, and maybe they're just not devious enough. I don't know, but you know, either way, I think as long as they are able to make one point, that's the main thing to take from that anyway. And so with evaluation, it's really making it, you're putting your putting your flag down from the very moment you start as to which area you begin with, as to where you are. That flag never leaves that particular argument. You never take the flag out and plunk it next door in the other argument and say that the other side's weak halfway through. You know, we've seen students do this, haven't we, where they'll say, however, this is completely wrong, because you think, no, you think it's right. You know, some people think it's wrong, and this is an example of why they might be right, but you think they're wrong. Just be clear on that. And that's the main thing to take from that as well. So over the course of the last hour and a half, we have looked at comparative theory, we've looked at ideology, and we've looked at evaluation. If there's an appetite, we can go on and look at more things in the future, if there's anything that we do. So I've put my Twitter handle in the message there. So it's Chris_W1987. But for those listening on catch up, I'll say it again. So it's Chris_W1987. And if you would like to make it clear what it is that you would like to discuss in the future, then please feel free to let me know. We can have further discussions about this as well. So thank you very much for your time today. And for those listening on catch up, I really hope that you have the opportunity to listen to this back and just see the three elements that we discussed there. And until next time, And next time will be on the 28th of April, where we will go less politics. Next time we're going to look at cognitive load. So we're going to go back to teaching and learning. I will see you then with my special guest at the time. Until next time, good luck with your exams and good luck with your revision and good luck with everything. Take care.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.